This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and today we start in our kitchens. The CDC estimates that 1 in 6 people in the country experience a foodborne illness every year. These illnesses can come from things like improper food storage, not cooking food to the recommended temperature, or just not washing your hands enough. In this edition of Be Well, which is our regular segment where we discuss ways to achieve wellness, we want to talk about safe ways to handle food at home. Saba Waheed Duffy is part of the catering business development at New England Culinary Arts Training, or NECAT. NECAT's a nonprofit organization that provides people with the technical and professional skills to get jobs in the culinary industry. Saba, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So you're a chef instructor there. So we're going to start with a lightning round, Saba, on some of these food safety items. So you just give me trues or falses.
Absolutely.
Right? Sure. True or false? Vegetables don't need to be washed.
False.
True or false? All proteins should be rinsed prior to seasoning.
That's a tough one. It does depend on the protein, so there's not a clear
Okay, so give me one that should be washed.
I would say that fish, definitely, because there's oftentimes, some debris or seawater that sometimes you do need to rinse
and off. One that doesn't need to be washed before you season.
I would say beef.
Okay, there we go. Some foods don't need a lid in the refrigerator, true or false?
I would say when you're storing food, once it's cooled to the proper temperature, everything should be covered
no matter what.
It doesn't leak or bleed or potentially cross-contaminate. But you can cool foods in the fridge without a lid on.
Okay, the problem for me with that is I would easily forget that I had food cooling in the fridge that didn't have a lid on. So put a lid on it, basically.
Put a lid on it.
Okay, and last true or false, wash your hands after handling eggs.
I say 110% yes.
Okay. All right, so that just gives us a sense of the kind of common practices in a kitchen that keep us safe, keep our food safe. So I want to talk a little bit about cooking safety in addition now. So you teach these skills to students. What are some of the first things that you teach students about the safe handling of food in the kitchen to keep people from getting sick?
Well, one of the first parts of our curriculum when they are in the classroom is serve safe. If you are going into a professional culinary environment, you have to get ServeSafe certification, and that means you are taught the basics of time, temperature control, how to store food, what temperature to cook foods to, how to properly thaw, cool, store, and all of the above. That's one of the first things you have to learn, and you actually have to pass an exam before you can proceed on to the next part of the classroom instruction.
And how did you learn all of this? Like, I'm assuming you did ServeSafe at some point.
Yeah, so there's two different types of certification. You can get just ServeSafe certified, and there's also the managerial one, which is a little bit more difficult, but if you are going to go into a management role or have your own business, food business, you do need to get the managerial certification.
Okay, but since we're talking now about people's kitchens at home, when you did ServeSafe, did you find that the basic practices were pretty much basic common sense, or were there things that surprised you?
I believe that because I'm a culinary professional, it is common sense to me, but I feel like a lot of home cooks wouldn't necessarily have that same diligence, especially when it comes to a thawing meat, for example. This is a huge one that
okay,
I see
so talk
a lot.
About that.
Oftentimes, I see or hear people, talking about defrosting chicken, and they'll pull the package of chicken out in the morning before they leave for work, leave it on the counter, and come back to thawed chicken. That's a huge no-no.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, that is like a bacteria fun fest over there, because that chicken is going to go into what we call the temperature danger zone. So that's, a very specific window of time, and the chicken's temperature will linger in that temperature zone for an extended period of time.
And
if it's
bacteria thawing, love that zone.
Oh, yes.
Okay, so let me ask you a question then. It's hard for a lot of people in their busy lives to remember a day or two before to put that chicken from the freezer into the refrigerator. So let's say it's Wednesday morning and I forgot to take the chicken out of the freezer and I can't put it on the counter because of the bacteria fest you just told me about. What can I do? Should I just defrost it in a microwave when I get home from work that night? Do we not eat chicken that day? You know, what can people do?
So there is a couple of different methods. One is to thaw it under cold running water.
Okay.
This is the fastest way to do it. You do obviously have to keep the water running.
Yeah, use a lot of water.
You got to use a lot of water. So there is a downside to it.
Okay.
Another method is using a steam oven, which is really an expensive. Nobody has those at home. So that is another method. And yes, it behooves me to say a microwave because it will compromise the integrity of your protein. It won't be as good. You'll get a sort of rubbery texture, but it is quick and it is effective.
Okay, we're talking with Saba Waheed Duffy of NECAT about food safety in the kitchen. Just a few other things, Saba. I'm seasoning meat. Every time I touch the meat, I have to wash my hands?
Absolutely.
There we go.
Yeah, there's no question about that, because what's going to end up happening is, say you know, as you're seasoning the meat, you're marinating it, and now you remember, oh, I forgot to put, the black pepper in here. Let me go grab my pepper grinder. Guess what? The hands that you just used to marinate the meat are now contaminated. If you go and grab your pepper grinder, start grinding pepper into your meat, that pepper grinder is now contaminated.
It's got bacteria fest on it.
The bacteria fest is there. You put it down and then you forget. And somebody else could go and touch that pepper grinder, and now you've cross-contaminated and you've transferred that bacteria. So always wash your hands between any task, especially with raw meat, or get gloves.
All right, let's do one more lightning round on storage here. I'm going to give you some items people use to store food in the refrigerator or freezer, and you tell me, okay, not okay. Wrap it up in tinfoil.
Not okay.
Wrap it up in plastic wrap.
Yes.
Ziploc bag.
Yes.
Some kind of Tupperware.
Yes.
Paper towel?
No.
Okay. So a seal, is that the issue?
I think there's two things. The seal is definitely going to prevent it from drying out. So wrapping it nice and tight will prevent any pockets of air, or will slow down the deterioration process, right? And prevent it from drying out. Foil, I've seen people put like slices of pizza, in foil and put it in the fridge. That's fine. I mean, it's going to dry out anyways, but I wouldn't put like a leftover piece of chicken, because you're not doing the chicken any service.
So no Chef Joe Gatto's tacos from yesterday wrapped up in a piece of foil and put in the refrigerator.
It depends on what you're going to do with that taco after. I mean, that I wouldn't advise eating that taco later, because that's just not going to taste good.
It's not going to taste good.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. I mean, that, like, if you wrapped a taco in plastic, it's still going to not be great the next day, but you're at least preventing it from drying out even further.
All right. Saba Waheed Duffy is a chef instructor at New England Culinary Arts Training, or NECAT. Thanks for joining us for Be Well.
My pleasure.
So we'll turn now to the question of expiration dates, which is the other big question that comes up when it comes to food safety. Doug Rao is the president and founder of Daily Table, a Massachusetts-based nonprofit community grocer dedicated to providing fresh food at a lower cost than grocery stores. Also former CEO of Trader Joe's, and this is an issue he knows a lot about. Welcome back to the show, Doug.
Well, thank you, Tiziana. It's great to be here. And just a little promotions. I was president, not CEO.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And that was just my mistake. I was riffing and put the Trader Joe's thing in there. And so that was just my mistake, Doug. All right. So listen, I want to talk about, you and I have talked over the years, this is something you've thought a lot about. Tell us, what is myth and what is real about sell-by and expiration dates that grocers put on food?
Yeah, this is probably one of the least understood parts of the entire food system. And first of all, usually grocers put a few code dates on, but mostly it's manufacturers and the producers that then put the code date on. One of the things that most people don't understand is that, first of all, only infant baby formula actually has any federal regulation around it. Other than that, it's either state by state or just up to the manufacturers to use best practices. And what it's really intended to do is to try to assist the customer from making sure they have the food when it's at its peak quality. Very few foods actually spoil to the point where you shouldn't eat them. And so the first thing about code dates is that they're very confusing. As we all know, there's everything from best by, sell by,
right,
best used by, you know, enjoy by, etc.
Doug?
Yep.
There. Okay, sorry. It sounded like you were going to say more, and then I thought I lost you there. All right, so that gets very confusing. We've got all of these different things. Only baby formula is regulated federally. So how do I know, Doug, whether it's safe to use, and I'm going to pick two different kinds of things, a pack of Ritz crackers after whatever the date is on a box of Ritz crackers, and a gallon of milk after whatever the nondescript date that's stamped on that gallon of milk is?
Yeah. So the Ritz crackers are very simple. Ritz crackers, I mean, the worst thing that happens is it starts to go stale. And in rare cases, the oils could oxidize and it can go rancid. You're going to know that. Your nose is going to know it. You're going to taste it. It's not going to hurt you.
Doesn't make you sick.
No, it's not going to make you sick. I mean, Ritz crackers will last for quite an extended time because they'll also really let you know, I'm not enjoying eating this, but it's not going to make you sick.
Okay.
Milk on the other side, milk, obviously has a code date on it. It has a best of use by, et cetera. And with milk also happens to let you know, if you're paying attention, when it's starting to go bad, because if you use anything hot, it'll curdle. And if you smell it, it'll turn sour. Our senses are designed around that. However, there's all kinds of things. You can go on the web and look this up. There's plenty of people that announce this, that, milk and milk alternatives are usually good for at least 7 days past the code date on the carton. And I say usually, and that's because it's all about time and temperature. And so it's about what's the temperature refrigerator. Almost nobody knows that. But if your refrigerator just happens to be running warm, like at 46 degrees, you're going to reduce the amount of time that milk is good anyway.
Okay.
So it's really about, it's a little tricky, but the nice thing about milk and the vast majority of foods is they let you know if, if they're starting to go.
And Doug, if I'm cost conscious and waste conscious, it sounds like a colder refrigerator is actually a good way to both help me not waste food and to keep it safe longer so I can use it.
Yeah, that is true. That for every 2 degrees above 38 that milk is stored, you lose a day of code.
Okay. So let's play a lightning round here, Doug. I'm going to give you some items that could be found in my fridge, my freezer, and my cupboard. And I'll have you just sort of say X amount past date is okay. How's that sound?
All right.
All right.
Fair enough.
Carrots.
Okay. Well, carrots are good until a basic. Now you're talking about, not talking about shredded carrots, but a whole carrot.
A whole carrot. That's right.
Yeah. A whole carrot will let you know, because when you can basically tie it in a knot, don't eat it.
And short of that, we're okay. And I'm sorry, I have to say this, Saba's still sitting here in Studio 2, and you just made her laugh out loud.
Yeah, I mean, basically, a carrot, as long as you wash it and stuff, it's not a food safety, it's a quality issue.
What about, sliced ham from the deli or sliced cheese from the deli?
Well, those are very different. Sliced ham, you should first of all, utilize good thinking in the sense that you're going to buy it for use within the next couple of days.
Okay.
You can always freeze it to save money. Instead of letting the food spoil, your freezer is your friend, and meat will last for a number of months in the freezer. But you don't want to with deli meats, raw meat, or raw fish. That's not where you want to push the envelope on code dates.
And can I put pretty much anything in the freezer to keep it going for me, Doug, if I don't think I'm going to use it? Again, being cost conscious.
Not raw eggs, but other than that, yes. And what will happen is the quality of if you freeze some zucchini, for instance, or even potatoes, the texture of them won't be as good, but you can always use them in soups, etc. So yes, I would say that the freezer is your friend to make sure that you can help reduce the amount of food that's going to waste.
Okay. And last two, pasta and rice in my cupboard.
Are you talking about dry pasta?
Dry.
Oh my gosh. Dry pasta lasts for years. It's really about oxidation. They're very, very slow. About, again, the same sort of staleness issue. It basically will last for, pasta will last for several years. White rice will last for several years. The brown rice only lasts usually about a year because it's got with a little more oil and the bran in there that tends to oxidize.
All right. Well, Doug Rao, president and founder of Daily Table, which is a Massachusetts-based nonprofit. Thanks for helping us be well. It was great to talk to you.
Great to be here. Thanks, Tiziana.
There's more ahead. It was early in the morning, a couple days before Halloween, when Carmen realized that her 12-year-old daughter, Haley, wasn't in her room. Using her phone, Carmen located Haley walking around near the downtown area of their town, and she talked about the experience from behind tears with WBUR senior health reporter Martha Biebinger.
And she don't know the danger that she was taking out there, walking in the middle of the night. Anything can happen.
WBUR with Martha made the decision to only use Carmen and Haley's first names. From there, Carmen found more evidence that her daughter needed mental health support, and she did the only thing she knew to do.
So that's when we went to the hospital because also she had thought to kill herself and everything. It was a lot.
Haley had to stay in the hospital, which scared her.
I didn't know if they were just going to send me home or if they were going to, like, put me in a really weird place. It was, like, really nerve-wracking.
Haley and Carmen's experience is heartbreaking, but it's not unique. The week that Haley went to the hospital, she was one of 115 children and teenagers who came to Massachusetts hospital emergency rooms and mental health crises and got stuck there for treatment. And that is according to the reporting from Martha Biebinger, who was looking at a new state program that wants to change that by diverting children and teens from ERs to their homes for mental health treatment. Martha is here now from the newsroom. And as I welcome you, Martha, let me say to listeners, if you or someone you know or love is experiencing distress or experiencing difficult thoughts, you can call the Suicide and Mental Health Crisis Hotline at 988. Welcome back, Martha.
Hi, Tiziana.
So, tell us a little bit more about what happened for Carmen and Haley.
So Carmen and Haley are somewhat common in terms of those children that we see in the hospital emergency rooms. They had not had an encounter with a mental health system before. So it was their first time trying to understand what to do in the middle of a mental health crisis. So they went to the only place they know, which is a hospital emergency room. The state is trying to offer some more community-based options for people, but they're also, with this program, trying to figure out how many of those children who show up like Haley really need to go to a psychiatric hospital or could go back home. In Haley's case, because this was her first encounter with the mental health system, going right to a psych ward felt like a big leap. And that could have added some trauma to her whole experience of trying to understand what was going on, what was driving her to do these risky things. So going back home and figuring out how to work this out at home really made the most sense to both the people in the emergency room who were evaluating her and to Haley and her parents.
So, Martha, it strikes me. So I listened to your story when it came out. I've read it several times. What you just said made me understand, I think, in a different way for the first time. The part of the challenge with boarding and waiting to get psychiatric beds, for example, is that there can be the trauma of awaiting and transferring and getting into treatment that is its own thing, over and above the trauma of the mental health crisis. And it sounds like these diversion programs, which do home-based treatment, both shorten that boarding, quote-unquote, process we have, but may reduce that transitional trauma as well.
Exactly. I was just talking to a father yesterday who said his child waited in a hospital for a week with a guard outside his room to be sure that he didn't leave. He was completely cut off from everything except the family members who were allowed in and out. It's very traumatizing in the middle of a crisis to not be getting any care and then to have this layer of, you know, basically being imprisoned for however long it takes to be transferred to a place where you can get some help.
So now take us, I'm going to bring another voice in a minute, but before I do, Martha, take us through how one of these diversion programs actually works. What happened for Haley when she went back home?
The first thing that happens is a safety sweep to make sure that the home is, in fact, a safe place for the child to be. And that could be locking up things that they might use to harm themselves. In Haley's case, it meant taking away her phone because she was using her phone to send some sexually explicit pictures that were getting her into some more trouble. So the ongoing program is 3 times a week of intensive counseling with Haley alone and a counselor, Haley and her parents, or whoever else might be relevant to her situation. And almost all of that happens in a living room or at a kitchen table. Sometimes, in the case of Haley, she might go for a car ride with her counselor, or she might meet her at a library or a McDonald's or something like that. But it's always in the community, in the setting, where there are often triggers, things that set children off and lead to the anxiety, depression, or in Haley's case, risky actions.
In order to help Haley then deal with those triggers as they happen, mm-hmm. respond to them, and practice safer behaviors.
Exactly.
All right. Yep. So I'm going to bring a second voice in now, Martha. Mary Viano is the associate director at the Parent Professional Advocacy League, which is a statewide organization that advocates for improved mental health services for kids and families. I know you spoke with Mary for this story. Mary, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Mary, first, let me just get your reaction to Carmen and Haley's story as Martha has told it. Does that sound, I don't mean to say typical because that might be belittling, but familiar maybe is the word.
Sure. I would say it's typical, it's familiar, and it's really accurate. When families go in to a crisis and go to an emergency department, exactly that feeling of not knowing what's happening and trusting a hospital to really help you with those next steps. But the trauma-induced reactions that happen while you're waiting, like that security guard that was at the door that Martha had mentioned for another young person, that's really what it looks like and it feels like for families.
So, Mary, as I'm listening to Martha talk about this diversion program, I'm thinking of the really significant number of people in my own life that I know who have had in the last few years experiences with their adolescent kids boarding in emergency rooms, boarding in hospitals. And I can imagine those folks and other listeners saying, well, wait a minute, if this kind of diversion program exists, why are we using this, right? Why are so many people stuck in emergency rooms?
So I think the hope is, as it started in the pandemic, so I think it's really important to mention that there was a problem prior to the pandemic, but the pandemic really affected the amount of young people that are going to the emergency department. So the numbers of children and families that are being seen by the hospitals are really hard. We do believe, as Martha's mentioned, that the diversion program is a positive piece. We would love to see this actually happen more. And to start the program, it did start with smaller amounts of slots for a way to kind of say it, opportunities for families. But we would really like it offered to more families and more families sooner than later.
So let me come back to Martha for just a second. Martha, in your reporting, you compared the cost of providing these kinds of services for 3 months for a kid like Haley versus even a day in the hospital. What are we talking about there?
$8,500 on average for 3 months, Tiziana, versus about $5,000 for 1 day in an ER. So you can see how quickly that expands before a child is even getting any treatment.
So if a child is boarding in an ER for 10 days waiting for a mental health bed, that's a $50,000 expense.
Very good.
Oh my.
Shocking, but very good.
Yeah. So, Mary, let me come back to you then. With that math still hanging over our heads here in Studio 2, as you are advocating for more diversion programs, more opportunities to take different paths, with those kinds of numbers in your toolkit, what kind of response are you getting from policymakers, nonprofit leaders, et cetera?
I think there's a collaboration and a partnership that's happening. We're really taking a look at it, I think, for the first time to look at the costs that can be saved and also the trauma that can be reduced and actually diminish if we're able to do that sooner. I would also add in the cost savings, we have to keep in mind as well, if a child was on a medical floor, they receive medical help immediately. When you are boarding for mental health, you don't receive the help. And though there are times that hospitals are really trying hard to piece things together, you don't have an opportunity of treatment and getting to a place of healing. So for us as an advocacy organization, PAL believes this is a win-win for everyone. It's a win-win for the systems, the cost savings, but most importantly, ending the unnecessary trauma that happened to those young people and families.
And Mary, when you say PAL, you're talking about your organization, the Parent Professional Advocacy League. So last question for you, Mary. What I do understand is it's not a weakness, it's a structural reality of a diversion program like what Martha has reported on versus in hospital or, you know, in medical facility care is the medical dimension of this. Maybe you need a prescribing psychiatrist. Maybe you need an acute medical intervention. For those cases, I understand we just still need to have enough medical beds and psychiatric medical beds. And how far are we between what we need for those cases and what we have? Do you know?
So I would say from what I'm hearing, we have the beds. Unfortunately, they're not staffed right now because of workforce issues. And I would lead more towards the young people that are coming in that can be diverted. And just like Martha had mentioned, you know, was this an opportunity for this young girl, Haley, to actually get the community support first before actually going away from her family for a period of time? I think that this is a place that we can really look at and focus to create some community connections. I do think that the prescribers, as you've mentioned, is a challenge, but we are a commonwealth that has great universities and colleges and wonderful thinking, I guess, out of the box thinkers. So I really hope that this is an opportunity in partnership in the state to figure out what we can do. If the prescriber is the only piece that is waiting for a child, let's figure it out as a commonwealth together.
All right. Mary Viano is the associate director at the Parent Professional Advocacy League, which is a statewide organization that advocates for improved mental health services for kids and families. Mary, we're going to say goodbye to you here. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
And still with us here, WBUR senior health reporter Martha Biebinger. Martha, I keep hearing parents in my head who are hearing this conversation saying, okay, so wait, how do I get to be the one? And what do I need to advocate for in the hospital if my child is there? And how do I avoid being in this position in the first place? And I know this is an area you've done a lot of reporting on. What is the wisdom that you've gained for families in looking at all of this?
The state is starting to build out options for parents. There are some new community behavioral health centers that we hope, the state hopes, will address problems before they rise to the level where somebody needs to go to an emergency room. Diversion is not in every hospital in the state. It's in 37, and we need it in every hospital. I think we need to prove the case that it works, and then it will be more widely available. I think parents need to connect to groups like Mary's to say, what are my options? Where should I go? What can I do for my kid?
And you raise a really interesting point here, Martha. We talk about Haley. We started this with Carmen and Haley, right? Your story. Getting services, getting treatment at home. But do we know if it works? Do we know that that diversion program is effective for a kid like Haley? What do we know there?
We know that of the nearly 500 children who've been through these programs, that 83% have not gone back to an emergency room. So 17% have had some kind of relapse. We know that over 90%, it's about 91%, have completed the program or been transferred to something that is appropriate. So we're starting to get some numbers about how this works for what kids in what situations. We don't have comparison over a year or two to how that compares to a psychiatric stay, for example. That is really something that won't happen until we've done this for a little while longer.
And you know, Carmen and Haley, this is a private story. This is an intimate story.
Yeah.
What made them decide to share it?
Carmen said that she really doesn't like people in her business. She had a hard time reaching out for help herself, and then she had a hard time sharing her story. But she did explain a little bit about why she did that.
A lot of parents don't know what the kid's going through because they don't want to accept that your kids really need help. I'm bringing you guys to my house, and hopefully this can help all the family, you know?
Was it hard to report on this?
No, because it's hopeful, Tiziana. What's hard is reporting on perennial problems where nothing shifts. Here you're starting to see a shift.
So what do you think you'll follow next?
Well, I think it's important to check back with Haley. I think it's important to check back with the program to see how it's developing. But it's also really important to understand all of the other barriers that factor into the reasons that we have a lot of kids showing up in emergency rooms. Can we address these problems earlier on? Can we improve payment so that more hospitals can offer psych care? What happens with staffing, the problem that Mary talked about? There's many threads that are contributing to this, but diversion is one that I think the expansion of will offer some relief.
All right, WBUR senior health reporter Martha Biebinger, always great to have you here in Studio 2. Thank you.
Nice to see you.
We end today in the classroom, where despite having more than a dozen active Indigenous tribes in the Northeast, including three in the Commonwealth that are either recognized federally or by the state, there's minimal standards on what education on those communities should look like beyond the first Thanksgiving.
And I think students don't realize the connection that we all have to native culture and language. We say Massachusetts so many times, day in and day out, living in the state. And how often do we think about that term being an indigenous word and the fact that Brookline High School is on Massachusetts land?
That's Elizabeth Lizzie Buell, who's a history teacher at Brookline High School. And today we're taking a look at what's being taught now and what could and should be taught in the future as people begin to organize to address what's missing. With us now on the line is Mattawee Monroe of the United American Indians of New England and the Massachusetts Indigenous Legislative Agenda. Mattawee, welcome.
Good morning. My name is Mattawee, by the way.
Mattawee. I'm so sorry to mispronounce it, Mattawee. Thank you for that. And we have, joining Mattawee and me, two educators. The first is Carrie Dunn, who is a History and Social Studies Department head at Lexington High School, and Taylor Collins, who is a History and Social Studies teacher at Framingham High School. Carrie, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Taylor, welcome to you here in Studio 2.
Yes, thank you for having me.
So what we have with the three of you is two people with teaching experience, one who's working on advocacy awareness change. And I want to ask all three of you, when we say Indigenous education, what do we mean? And Mattawee, I will start with you.
Sure, I would love to talk to you about that. Right now we have a bill that's presented at the Massachusetts State House, which calls for celebrating and teaching Native American cultures and history. And that is a call for a curriculum that would be statewide in all the public K through 12 schools here. When we're talking about teaching Native history and cultures, we're really talking about not only teaching history, but having Indigenous content through embedded throughout the content. That is, there, in addition to teaching some Indigenous history, it would be important to talk about contemporary Indigenous issues, making sure that the students all understand that Indigenous people continue to live here in Massachusetts and continue to be alive. I say that because a poll a couple of years ago said that non-Native people, about 40% of non-Native people, think that Native Americans are extinct. So it's important for students to understand that we're still here, and for curriculum to be embedded throughout their learning experience K through 12, so that there would be books written by Native authors, there would be Native art presented, there would be Native music presented. So instead of it being an idea that, okay, well, now it's fourth grade and we're going to stop and do a unit on the Wampanoag, it would be really important to be talking about the various Indigenous nations and Indigenous peoples here in Massachusetts throughout the school year, and also bringing attention to other Native people from outside the state as well, and contemporary issues.
So Mattawee, when we spoke with Mashpee Wampanoag historian Paula Peters during our conversation on Indigenous Peoples Day, she told a story from her own childhood that underscored one of the things that you said. And I want to hear that here.
When another child asked what happened to those Indians, the teacher just said, oh, well, they've all died. We've come a really long way from then. I had to raise my hand and say, hey, wait a second, that's not true.
So I'll turn to you, Taylor Collins, from Framingham High School here in Studio 2. Mattawee gave us a very rich picture of what it means to do Indigenous education. We heard that underscoring of the absence of real awareness and presence in the classroom from Paula Peters there. As you think about teaching history, but also bringing Indigenous perspectives and an Indigenous dimension to all that we are teaching, what's important to you in the classroom, and why is it important to do it?
I think it's super important, like you were saying, to bring it throughout the year. I remember having a student asking, like, are Indigenous people still alive? And I thought I did my job perfectly and worked hard on that. And then I realized I had to look back on my own biases and where and unpack how I was taught about this and to see what lens I'm teaching this through. And so one of the things that I really want kids to take is looking at primary sources and becoming historians themselves and analyzing and learning the truths or understanding like how to argue what's going on and connecting it to modern day issues, like they were saying, and seeing like how to make them better citizens by understanding what's going on in the world and how our history has affected what we're going through today.
So we're talking here on Radio Boston about teaching Indigenous and Native American history in the Massachusetts classrooms and the fact that we don't have a strong regular standard for that or a robust standard for that. We just heard from Taylor Collins at Framingham High School. I'm going to turn now to Carrie Dunn, who's at Lexington High School, and I'm going to pick up on something that Taylor just said, Carrie. This is Elena Shorey, who's a history teacher, one of Taylor's colleagues at Framingham High School. Here she is.
We were fed a very colonized, white, you know, Eurocentric, male elite narrative of the United States, even in college courses. And so a lot of work needs to be done personally first, especially I'm a white woman. Like, that work needs to be done internally for myself. To me, I think that's one of the biggest challenges that districts face is giving educators the time and space to do that, and then also pushing educators to do that as well. It's not a choice. We need to do this for our students. We need to do this for their survival.
And for you, Carrie, is that the big challenge? Are there other challenges as a teacher who wants to, and my understanding from your conversations with our team before the show, you want to be teaching more than you are. What are the challenges that you're facing?
So I, of course, want to be teaching more. I think every good history social studies teacher out there in Massachusetts right now should be mindful of teaching an Indigenous perspective throughout the scope of American history. I think we absolutely could be doing more with contemporary issues related to Native American peoples in our country and in our state, right? A challenge, but I think it's a good challenge, and it's kind of an exciting challenge, is to really get away from conventional textbooks as the content that we're using as classroom resources when we're teaching about Indigenous history or contemporary issues. There are many good alternative resources out there. I've seen a lot of high school teachers here at Lexington High School use excerpts from Roseanne Dunbar Ortiz, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. It's an excellent book. The Smithsonian National Museum of American History has a free online website now for educators called Native Knowledge 360. Really high interest, great visuals, good quality resources. We don't need to be using kind of stale old textbooks that might present a problematic narrative any longer. So we need time to investigate and find the best stuff out there.
So I'll turn back to Matowi Monroe. Am I doing that well now?
Sure you are.
Excellent. From the United American Indians of New England, I'm going to play you a little sound from a teacher in the Lowell Public Schools. His name is Robert DeLosa, and how they're thinking about their lessons going forward.
One of the questions in the program we're piloting is, how has the country developed and who has borne the costs? This is not to denigrate the country, to somehow slam us. But we need to know that it is complex and that there have been people who have especially heavily borne the costs of creating this hugely powerful, wealthy country that we have, where we still are working to live up to the founding ideals of this government and this nation.
What strikes me is not only his acknowledging that there is serious anxiety and pushback about the truth-telling that we're seeking to do about the complexity of our history, but also the need for it. And I want to ask you, what do we lose collectively as a Massachusetts community when we don't include Indigenous history, Indigenous cultures, Indigenous experiences fully and appropriately in what we teach our kids as they're growing up?
Well, I would start out by saying that it's obviously harmful to Indigenous students in any school system to be in a school system where they have teachers having them dress up as pilgrims and Indians for a Thanksgiving that is not examined historically, or to have them singing about how Columbus discovered America for you and me, as my children experienced when they were kindergartners in a public school here in Massachusetts, for instance. But it's very clear from what we've heard from many, many parents and students and teachers that
there's a real hunger to learn more about Native Americans. There's a real desire to learn more about the history, and it's not accessible to people. I understand that there's excellent books around with a national narrative, such as Dunbar Ortiz's book and several others, but we don't have the materials at hand for teachers to be able to use here in Massachusetts. It's important for all of our children to understand whose land they're on. If you're in a school in central Massachusetts, you should understand that you're on Nipmuc land. If you're in a school on the Cape, you should understand that you're on Mashpee Wampanoag land. There are, you know, tribal nations all around the state. There are more than three. And children should have this understanding of whose land they're living on and what the history of colonialism and displacement is in that area as well. I think that a lot of teachers really want to teach this confident, but this content, but they don't feel confident about it. And there's good reasons for it. They haven't grown up learning it either. And that's why we want to provide some kind of standardized Massachusetts-based curriculum that will be ready for teachers. They can feel confident about it. They can get extra trainings in it. And they will also understand how to indigenize their classroom more so that they can use Native culture and other content throughout the year. You know, teachers don't want to make mistakes, and sometimes even well-intended teachers can make mistakes and do things like, I don't know, for younger kids, we've seen teachers have the kids make up their own Native American names, which is actually offensive. We've had teachers who do things like say, well, if you had been Native American, how would you have felt about the Indian Removal Act? And that's not appropriate because it's asking students, instead of just looking at history and what actual Indigenous people said about it, for them to imagine that they're Indigenous and have experienced a horror that they actually cannot imagine. Teachers do sometimes make mistakes. We want to help them with that and give them the curriculum that they need.
I want to bring in Taylor Collins here, who's in from Framingham High School, who's here in Studio 2, because you were nodding so much. So, no, that's good. So just pick up, because you're underscoring what we just heard.
Yeah, there's a couple things I wanted to pick up on. Right before I left class today, I asked my kids, I told them what I was doing, and they were all really excited. And I was like, why do you think we need to learn this? And a lot of kids were like, how are we going to know who we are as a nation, as a state, as people, if we don't understand the real history? And some of my kids were actually really angry because some of the history they learned when they were younger was trivialized.
How old are they?
My kids are 10th grade.
Okay, keep going.
So, hi, kids. Okay. And so they were really upset of how, like, not learning the truths behind it. And one of the really, like you were saying, the challenges too, though, for teachers is, yes, they can mess up. And this is a great bill too. But having a legislature, you know, having like a whole curriculum for them is something that needs to back it up. Because just reading a book doesn't make you an expert. We have to really unpack a lot of our biases and a lot of the ways that we've been taught and realize some of these things that we've done in the past have actually been really problematic.
Yeah.
And so it's an ongoing, kind of like what Elena was saying, it's an ongoing process. It's a very humbling process and really opens your eyes. And our kids are wanting this history. I'm on Nipmuc land where I teach, and Natick is right next door. That's a praying town. The kids never knew that it was a praying town.
What does that mean?
So a praying town was used by the Puritans to convert the indigenous people of that area into Christianity, but they had to lose all of like their customs, they had to cut their hair, they had to speak English. And during the King Philip's War, which a lot of time is trivialized too, and just said this is the last time they ever resisted, which is also not true, the people that were converted, that were supposed to be protected, were actually sent out onto an island in the Boston Harbor, Deer Island, and were left for dead, and they were sent out during the winter time. So one of our lessons we do is learning about that, and also like what can we do as citizens who think that this history needs to be known, because there really isn't much memorial. Most people don't even know about praying towns.
Yep.
Yeah. And also like Natick, you know, changed their mascot. So we also have that kind of current event going on. What are the mascots and what are the issues with that? So the students really want to understand it and then becoming more informed citizens. And that's what we want.
So I'm going to turn now to Carrie Dunn, who's on the line from Lexington High School, History and Social Studies Department head there. And as we start to wrap, we've got a couple of minutes left here, Carrie. I'm going to play a little sound from Anawan Whedon, who's a Mashpee Wampanoag educator, founder and owner of First Light Foundation. And he goes into schools and helps them teach Indigenous topics. And he talks a little bit about the challenge of doing that.
When I only visit a child and literally expose them to a culture that the kids are living in, they're living in our environment, they're living in our climate, they're eating our foods. We are not Europeans anymore, but we're still living a European way here in this country. And when most people in New England live their whole life, I'm talking adult, I'm talking senior citizens who have lived here their entire life, never met a native. And I have to like fix all that in 1 hour at second grade. I mean, it's really just a disservice to us.
So what do we need most in this moment, Carrie? What do you need most as a department head?
Oh, that's a great question. And I've been nodding hearing all of these excerpts. I do think attention and priority on this issue from our state DESE would be helpful, right? That this is an expectation. There are places in our Massachusetts standards that emphasize Native American history, both locally and nationally, and that, you know, more than kind of an optional encouragement to teach this, but it's an expectation to teach this needs to be communicated. Provisioning of resources, right? Opportunities to bring in guest speakers, take students out, right? Unfortunately, that's disproportionately available to schools and communities that have a lot of resources, but it benefits all students. So I would like to see this become a state issue and really embraced by our educational authority and pushed hard.
So there is so much more we could talk about here, but we are the realities of the time on this show. So at this point, I'm going to say thank you to our guests, Matawi Monroe of the United American Indians of New England, Taylor Collins, who's with the History Department at Framingham High School, and Carrie Dunn, who's the History and Social Studies Department head at Lexington High School. Thanks to all three of you for engaging. We will watch the progress of this bill. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And listen, listeners, we want to give you a heads up that this evening, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu will be giving her first State of the City address. All Things Considered begins here on WBUR at 4 p.m., and you can stay with All Things Considered for that coverage going into the evening. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening today. Why don't you join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.